person or young couple wants to get into farming, they get their egg, land, and then they both have to get, you know, government jobs to pay for it.
To buy land off one of the government auction type things is quite an onerous process. The only other way to do it is buy a farm from somebody, and they're unbelievably expensive. So you wonder why people can't farm. The price of land is just stupid, and it's not realistic at all.
Welcome to the Organic Matters podcast. My name is Dominique, and I'll be your host. What do you think about when you think of the Yukon? Vast expanses of wilderness? Cold and snow and ice? Maybe you think about the gold rush or the huge mining industry in the north. I bet you don't picture farms, right? But actually, agriculture in the Yukon has seen a steady increase since 1982, when the government started giving out free land to people who wanted to farm. In 2016, the Yukon Territory was home to a whopping 158 farms. Now, this might not seem like a lot compared to the amount of farms in southern Canada, but farming in the north isn't easy, and not a lot of people want to do it. 76% of the farms in the Yukon aren't even growing food for the people that live in the Yukon. They're growing hay to feed animals. 22% of farmland is producing field crops, mostly wheat, and only 2% of the farms in all of the Yukon are growing fruit and vegetable crops that are being locally consumed. And get this, only about 6% of the farms are run by people under the age of 35. The lack of agriculture meant for human consumption means that the territory relies heavily on imported foods from the south that are really expensive to ship, making prices for consumers increasingly unaffordable. The interest in organic farming has been growing in the Yukon, but the number of certified organic farms is still astonishingly low. In 2018, there were only 5 certified organic farms in all of the Yukon Territory. This podcast will try and answer this question. Why aren't there more organic farmers, or farmers in general, in the Yukon? To help answer it, I interviewed 2 farmers that live just outside of Whitehorse, the Yukon's biggest city. The first farmer is Bart Bounds. In the summer months, he stewards the 4-acre elemental farms where he grows an abundance of certified organic vegetable crops and raises certified organic laying hens and broilers. He has no problem selling all of his products at the local farmers market through farm gate sales and through his CSA program. In the winter, he volunteers on many agricultural committees and boards and dedicates an incredible amount of time to try and invoke change in the Yukon's agricultural policies and practices. In our conversation, Bart gave me insight into the incredible challenges that farmers in the Yukon face. So what would you say are your main struggles of farming in a northern climate, not necessarily organic farming, but just farming in general?
Specific to the, so one thing up here is that up here there's like no enforcement. There's no regional legislation, and there's no enforcement of the national legislation about the use of the term organic. So about 50% of the farms up here say they're organic, even though there's no way to quantify that they are. You know, there's no third body inspection. And being involved in the farming, a lot of aspects of the farming diaspora here, I I know that they're what they do is not organic necessarily. I mean, some of them definitely do some things that are organic, and some do a good job of what they're doing. But I have a pretty good understanding of the standards, and you know, I see a lot of things that I don't think would fly under an inspection, right?
So, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, mostly having to do with you know, especially with when it comes to animals. So another challenge, which is, you know, kind of has a bit of a silver lining, is that, you know, there's no big suppliers up here for any of the, you know, amendments or other resources or even tools that you might want to use. So, you know, accessing those and the cost of shipping those is, you know, like, for example, for organic fertilizer, or organic feed, you're paying almost as much as the cost of the product. Sometimes more.
Although farm inputs in the Yukon are really expensive, Bart explained that the silver lining to the expense is that it forces farmers to find ways to reduce inputs or produce their own inputs and work towards closing the loops on their farms. For example, every year Bart makes around 100 cubic meters of compost. He also grows some of his own animal feed, uses local fisheries waste to make his own fish fertilizer. So really, the main inputs that he has to ship in are chicken feed, mineral soil amendments, and some organic fertilizers.
Another challenge, and this is kind of probably ubiquitous in the organic world, is that educating your customers, you know, what makes something organic and why that's important. Because a lot of, you know, like here, a lot of people, and I imagine elsewhere, a lot of people hear the term local, mm-hmm. which is also not there's no real definition to that term.
Yeah.
Or except universal definition. But they hear local and they think, oh, then it's organic. You know, actually another big challenge, fourth big challenge would be labor. And that's, you know, goes for agriculture in general here, but... And that's kind of a double thing because one, there is not really a farming community up here per se, or an organic farming community up here per se. So there's not a pool of qualifiable labor. A lot of people think, oh, you just need somebody to pull weeds, or you just need somebody to do that. But especially when you come to an organic system. It has just as much skill and knowledge as any, you know, as being an electrician or a carpenter or whatever. So, and the second prong of that issue is that, you know, like, since you're competing against this industrialized, you know, system, it's hard to be able to provide your product at a price that's accessible to the community, you know, at large.
Yeah.
And pay a living wage to your workers, right? Or if you're doing an internship program, you know, to make sure that they're getting, you know, a reasonable, you know, compensation for their hard work, right? So.
Right. So how do you source a lot of your labor? Like where do your workers come from usually?
So I've tried a lot of different things over the years. In fact, it's gotten me so frustrated that I'm almost considering just taking a year off until I can figure out how to just do it myself.
Right.
But I've hired like employees. I've used an internship program and the challenge with the internship program, although, you know, I often get, enthusiastic people. They're usually students, and they're, you know, they can't make it for the whole season, so that's always a challenge. And you know, like the internship program here, the best I can offer them for a stipend is like $120 a week. So it's seasonal. It's you know, low paying work, and you know, a lot of the people you track like that are awesome people, but they're also, you know, have a lot of wanderlust, and they're out there trying to see the world and have experiences, you know, younger, which is great. However, a lot of times their commitment is low, a lot of times they're not real necessarily experienced farm workers. They'll have. Oh. Hold on. He left his dump truck outside.
Bart's also tried using woofers, but according to him, they're a pretty unreliable workforce. Sometimes you get really great people, and sometimes you don't. And no matter how good they are, they're on their own adventures, and they're only usually there to help for short periods of time. On top of that, Bart raises another issue.
One part of that aspect up here is that 70% of the people are directly or closely related to government jobs. So, you know, they're starting out at $25 an hour and with benefits and all that stuff. So you can't really compete with that. And it's an issue across all businesses here, right? Like unless you're a government business and can pay it, right? Like you can't keep an employee because as soon as they get that little job, you know, whether it's working part for the summer or whatever, they're gone.
Yeah, that's such a struggle. Because all these people that are working up there need food, and right now I think the Yukon is relying so much on imported food. So it's like such a crazy loop of unsustainability.
Yeah. Okay, great. So back to labor. So there's no real recognized or, you know, supported apprenticeship program for farming up here. For example, in all the trades, welding, carpentry, et cetera, you know, they have a program where you do an apprenticeship and then the government subsidizes part of the wages. So I've been trying to get something like that going up here, but it's hard to get people, you know, the well-educated policymakers and whatnot to understand that, you know, that farming, especially organic farming, is a trade and deserves the same respect and support, right?
Absolutely.
You know, and I think, you know, on a maybe unconscious or, you know, systemic level, for the establishment to admit that would be to admit that all farmers globally are extremely underrepresented as far as the sharing of profits that are made off of them. Fairness. Fairness is one of the four principles of organic farming, and it is the most neglected. Another challenge is climate change up here is so freaking real.
Yeah.
And so here we get, like last week, I had 9 degrees at my place. Right now we're minus 15. So.
Wow.
No, it's just becoming more up and down. The winds in the spring now are insane. They rip, you know, they did about $25,000 or more of damage to my place last spring, which wiped out all my savings, right? So here I am, you know, kind of at ground zero again. It's rough.
I asked Bart about the situation regarding land access for people who want to farm in the Yukon.
Yeah, same thing here. Land prices here are, you know, like we've got a population of 40,000 people, which works out to, I think, about one person per 10 square kilometers. So there's a lot of land here, and it's really, really expensive, especially if you're anywhere near Whitehorse, where the bulk of your clientele your consumers is going to be.
He then explained how this situation came to be. Let me sum it up. I mentioned earlier that in 1982, the government started giving out free 160-acre parcels of land to people who wanted to farm. In the early days, the regulations were pretty loose, and some people abused the system by getting title to a whole bunch of parcels, developing them, and then selling them as soon as they could. And, of course, in the first 20 years of land grants in the Yukon, all the really prime agricultural land close to Whitehorse was taken. The government still gives out parcels of land every year, but now the land isn't really free anymore. Stricter regulations have made it so that farmers have to meet certain requirements before actually getting title to the land, like having 53% of it cleared or broken for crop production. So if you're getting a 160-acre parcel, you have to clear just over 80 acres of it, which really is a ridiculous requirement if you just want to run a small-scale market garden. These regulations are really geared towards encouraging larger-scale, conventional farms that just grow field crops. So no wonder that's the only thing being grown in the Yukon. The other way to access land is to buy it outright, but Bart explained that the price of land in the Yukon is just outrageous and new farmers just can't afford it, unless you buy a property 5 or 6 hours from Whitehorse, which isn't ideal if your main market is in Whitehorse. Bart told me about a few properties he was just looking at.
So I was just looking at two yesterday, and they were, I think they were 10 hectares around that, around 10 hectares. And the down payment was like $160,000, just the down payment. But really, really expensive for anybody who is young and starting out and probably doesn't have a lot of money. So what the common thing here is young person or young couple wants to get into farming. They get their egg land, and then they both have to get, you know, government jobs to pay for it, let alone just developing it. I mean, to clear, you know, 80 acres, if you gotta have to clear half of it of a quarter section, I mean, that's $300,000 right there, probably, you know. So all of a sudden they're in debt up to their eyeballs. They're both working, you know, and you know, you have to get certain points of a development done to keep your egg lease. So then they're long and short, by the time they actually get possession of the land, they're totally burnt out on farming, because what they've done is they've created a conventionally farmed hay field to feed eight outfitters' horses, and they're just contracting somebody with the equipment to do it all for them. They are not farming. Wow. And it's a real bad situation, because maybe 95% or something of the farms up here pretty much just produce hay, and I only know of two farms that are producing organic hay. And most of that hay, you know, is sold to outfit, you know, hunting guides, outfitters to feed their horses. So it's not really, it's almost not really agriculture in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not about feeding people necessarily.
But they still get all the benefits and tax breaks and everything of being a farm.
So do you think that the main way that farmers are going to start farming in the Yukon is by government legislation and changes at the government level? Is that the only way it's going to happen?
That would be a very strong advocacy. That would be very supportive. So like my farm and the one other, you know, somewhat successful small scale, you know, mixed vegetable sort of operation in the Whitehorse area that are certified organic, we both have access to free land. And when the egg ranch like points to us as being successful farms, you know, I have to say, hey, it's because I have free land. That's why nobody else is able to do this. So
yeah.
You know, I've talked to them about doing like some sort of incubator farm project. I've talked to them about doing like long-term leases, smaller lots. You know, there's lots of, you know, like you just go look at Young Agrarians or any other number of, you know, proponents in areas that have the population of, you know, base to support, you know, such activities. And there's all kinds of great ideas there. And also another thing, the agricultural branch up here is pretty weak. It's just a subsection of the energy, mines, and resources, right? Like, it's not like it's even really its own entity.
Mm-hmm. In Whitehorse, where are people getting most of the food? Is most of it imported? Like, how much of a local food scene is there?
It's you know, it gets a lot of hype, but it's actually, the amount of local consumption is probably less than 1% of all the food up here.
Wow.
It might be 1% now. It's really grown over the last couple of years. But, you know, like the restaurants and the tourism people and the egg branch, and you know, talk about how great local food system is, But when you look at what they're actually doing to support it, not much.
Bart also explains that in Whitehorse, there's a lot of products that are labeled as locally made, but most of these products don't use locally grown ingredients. They're just actually physically made in Whitehorse.
You know, and when it comes to organic, there's one producer in particular up here who is selling his ungraded eggs to restaurants and stuff, calling them organic. He is in no way, shape, or form organic. And, you know, this has been brought to different authorities' attention, and there's no teeth in any sort of legislation or anything, so he just continues doing what he does with impunity. I've talked to the people because they'll have on their menu a locally grown organic pork, right? And I have to talk to them, like, well, where are you getting your pork? And they're like, oh, from so and so. And I'm like, well, he's not organic. you legally are not supposed to put that on your menu if it is not organic. You know, anyway, and like I said, it's a big public education piece and industry education as well, right? Yeah.
Yeah, so speaking of meat, like, have you had any challenges raising organic meat? Because I know it's a huge challenge for a lot of farmers because the standards are so strict about, like, sourcing organic feed and organic slaughtering. So how do you deal with that?
So as far as feed goes, like I said, it's just expensive. Like, we can get it, we just got, you know, so the challenge there is the price. You know, I've been pushing anybody to grow organic grains. I actually bought a small mill, so if anybody does, I can mill it, you know, and stuff like that. As far as the slaughter goes, there's one fixed inspected abattoir here and one mobile abattoir here. They can quite easily meet the organic standards in their setup. So that the slaughter part is not any more of a challenge for organic than for conventional up here.
Nice.
And dump poultry, because none of these facilities are approved for poultry. There is a poultry, slaughter facility, abattoir facility that is here, but as far as I know, it's not yet approved for commercial sales. So here we have compared to the rest of Canada, we still have pretty relaxed regulations around farm gate sales. So, like, I can sell directly to a consumer and not have to go through any sort of inspection or anything. So space requirements are a challenge, just because here, generally, your structures need to be a little bit more stronger, you know, for the weather conditions. Like my layers, which I keep year-round, you know, you, in the standards, you have to maintain a certain temperature. So that means increased, fuel usage, fuel cost. In combination with maintaining an active composting deep litter system in there. And the standards for poultry, for example, they have to have access to the outdoors. So for a good 6 months of the year, my chickens don't even want to think about going outside, right? So
absolutely.
So what I do is I run them in some of my high tunnels, but it is, you know, especially when it gets down to minus 40 and stuff, it's a lot of challenge just to keep everything going, you know, keep their water from freezing and keep them warm enough.
To end off our conversation, I asked Bart what his hopes for the future of farming in the Yukon were.
Well, honestly, at this point, I have to say I don't really have a lot of hope for it. But I would hope, you know, the more I look at the problems of this small scene in the north, or organics in general, which is growing rapidly, a lot of its problems are tied right in with all the other world's problems, like, this is a problem in the north, it's part of a bigger problem, right?
Absolutely.
You know, and
Canada is great in a lot of ways, but it's stepping right along with the present paradigm of intrinsically, if things are going to improve on anything, and I think everybody's starting to realize that, like, we have to, well, in my opinion, we have to tear down the structure and rebuild it better. So my hope for the UConn is that the ag policy eventually actually gets updated, and that it makes it so land is accessible both economically and temporally in a way that can promote small-scale producers, which don't need 160 acres, you know, which is most of them, unless they're growing hay for horses. Yeah, so I guess really my hope is broadening awareness in the general public of the value and importance and of egg organic product.
Bart also hopes that locally grown food, whether organic or conventional, will become more accessible to people in the area.
Like for me, I try to keep my food as affordable as possible because I think everybody should be able to get it.
Mm-hmm.
I hate it. I hate the idea of, like a lot of organic producers do, you know, they're at the farmer's market selling, you know, like a fair cost of what they're producing, you know, really. But the only people buying it are you know, the wealthier, better off people, you know. Like I would love for, in my opinion, the low-income families need it more than anybody else. Because they've got enough challenges, they don't need to eat shitty food too. Part of that problem is that we compete with the industrialized food system, who does not pay living wages. So if organic production, in its fairness, was to pay a living wage, like a true living wage, to its workers, problem I have, right? Like I tell people, it's like, unless you're really good, I probably can't pay you over $15 an hour, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which living wage here for a single person is $19 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
But so how do we pay the workers what they deserve and still compete with the international, you know, the big players in the conventional agriculture? We have to share the wealth that's made on organic inputs. We don't, you know, like small scale production, my workers are making about the same amount as me. Right.
Right.
And sometimes, you know, depending on how things go, maybe more. Yeah. It's huge. There's no simple answers. The simple answer is to completely ban conventional agriculture.
There you go.
So, and that ties into, like, probably for me, the biggest challenge here, even though I have free land, you know, I have a short growing season, so you really got to give her, right, to get as much out of it as you can. It's nice that I have a lot of more free time in the winter. But, you know, like, I got four kids. I mean, two of them are, you know, taking care of themselves. They're older. I don't really have a retirement. I don't have benefits. I don't, you know, like I don't make a lot of money. So you look at that and go, fuck, I'm working, you know. In an 8-month period, I'm putting in 2,500 hours, you know, more than most people put in a full year. You know, I live, you know, in a small yurt without electricity, without running water, you know, wood heat. You know, I love it in a lot of ways, but it's also very challenging, especially with children, you know, and, you know, I can't take vacations, you know, all these things, unless I decide to work full time in the winter also, but then I wouldn't have any energy in the spring to start this whole thing, you know. So it's the economics are probably the biggest challenge, but I think that's true for most small scale producers. So I don't know if that's specific to the North, other than having a shorter season where you got to work 50% more to make up for that part of the season when you're not going to have any product. Right?
Yeah, you definitely got to be passionate about what you do to make it work.
Yes, and. So the challenge is that the altruism might not be sustainable.
Bart's struggles are not unique. Farmers all around Canada, and really all around the world, are struggling with the same issues. Why doesn't our current system care more about farmers? Aren't they the ones growing all of our food? Shouldn't that be a priority? I really hope that Bart continues to care so much about what he's doing, and I hope positive changes will come that benefit him and his farm and his family. The Yukon really needs more people like him. The second farmer I talked to is Tom Rudge. He's been running Aurora Mountain Farm with his wife, Simone, since 2001. They used to have a small market garden, but now they mainly focus on raising certified organic laying hens and broilers, certified organic hay, and they're on their way to having the first certified organic pigs in the Yukon. They also raise cattle, but they're not certified organic yet simply because they can't source enough organic hay to feed them. In 2004, Simone and Tom were main players in founding the Fireweed Community Market, which is to this day still Whitehorse's biggest farmers market, and where local farmers sell most of their products. They just recently opened a butcher shop on their farm, where they sell the meat that they raise, as well as other locally sourced meat products. They also take part in discussions and sit on committees to try and create change in the agricultural policies in the Yukon. In our conversation, Tom tells me the reason they decided to get certified.
We sold our stuff at the farmer's market and a few other places and farm gate sales, and everyone said, well, you guys, are you organic? There just seemed to be this big interest in whether you're healthy food, organic, and how you're farming. And we said, no, we're not certified, but we follow along on the regulations. And at one point, we just said, you know, if we're going to say that, we might as well be organic. So that's when we took the jump and decided to do that. And it's not so much about the product as the process and supporting a national, federally regulated form of farming. It's the only one there is.
So what's the demand like in your community? Like, you're raising all this meat, but is it selling really quickly?
There's a huge interest in local because, and I'm just saying local in general, we've never had a problem selling all our product on farm gate sales. We've never had a problem selling it. And that's broilers and pork and beef. We haven't had a problem selling it. The biggest issue I was going to say is organic feed. And the price has gone from, like, when we first started, it was probably $500 to $600 a metric ton, and it was just over $150-$200 to ship it here.
Oh my gosh!
And as of last year, it's about $1,000 per ton for the feed, and the cost of shipping was almost around $800 a ton.
Wow.
So, anyways, nowadays I ordered up. Last time I ordered feed, I got a Super Bee. It's like one of those big two-compartment truck and trailer things.
Mm-hmm.
One of the big units, and they haul 40 tons.
Wow.
So we had organic layer, organic broiler, and a whole bunch of hog feed put in. And it brought the shipping down to about $250 a ton. But the price on the feed was still, it was up there. You know, it's $900 a ton.
I asked Tom about the challenges that he faces being an organic farmer in the Yukon. He had a lot of similar things to say as Bart did, like the mislabeling of non-organic products.
The trouble that we've had, I think, part of it, so you're dealing with high shipping, high feed costs for this, for organic. And then everyone says, well, you can, you know, geez, you can make a lot of money by calling yourself organic. And the trouble up here is that we set the bar and everyone sort of meets us. Like, they say, well, if you guys can sell it for that, we should be right near there, you know. Whatever we set the bar at for certified organic, the producer's right under, everyone else is right underneath that. And they do it without having the tremendous amount of paperwork and research that we've done to get where we are. So that's kind of hard. And part of it is the CFIA also, the Canadian Food Inspection Agency also says, we will take somebody to task on a complaint-driven basis on their labeling. But it's really hard if these guys use advertising on Facebook. The CFIA doesn't really have any issues around. They can't really go after people on advertising. They can on the labeling, but not on the advertising. So we don't necessarily get a price premium.
So why do you do it?
So why do we do it?
Why do you do it?
Because it's the only really good way to farm.
Tom also mentioned other challenges, like the short growing seasons, frequent frost throughout the growing season, poor quality soil, and climate change.
You know, I don't know what's going to happen with climate itself, because, you know, they talk about extending the warmth, the summers will be warmer. Well, the summer is pretty much the same, but it's in the shoulder seasons. You're getting a lot more, you know, it's warmer weather, but it's also cloudy. So being off the grid like we are, I rely on sunshine for the solar panels. And I really notice if there's clouds in the sky, my generator has to run a lot more, which it has. So
I asked Tom why he thinks there aren't more organic farms in the Yukon.
A lot of people are just, they like the ability to farm how they see fit. And they don't want to be regulated by it. So they want to feel free about doing whatever they want. And to a certain extent, I know for a fact, there's some of the farmers here that, you know, they feel threatened by the organic. I'm not threatening anybody. I'm just farming the way I want. But
right.
They, you know, a lot of them are still old school Alberta farmers. So, and they can sell everything they have without being organic. Right. So it is, to a great extent, it's that mindset. If I can sell everything I grow, why should I do it organically? And they can just about call themselves organic anyways. That's the big hurt up here, is that, you know, all the people that buy local figure, oh, it must be organic. It's so good up here. I can't lose sleep over it, and I can't make somebody change the way they farm. I can't do it.
For sure.
But I can push hard for what we do and hope to get the government support on it. You know, maybe someday somebody will look back and go, no, I should have been doing it that way. You know, look what happened to the farming, or look what happened to our food. So we'll see what happens. You know, eventually, but it's going to come around to, for some reason, things aren't working and people are going to have to change the way they farm, you know, to become more resilient.
Okay, so farmers might be really set in their ways and don't want to be told what to do, but why aren't there more small-scale farms that are producing food for communities in the Yukon? Tom gave me a good explanation.
Well, it might be turning around somewhat here. You know, there's a lot of push now for local, which there hasn't been. I'm sure it's the same down there. There's a, you know, nice push for that. But when the Canadian government, I mean, the biggest lobby power are all the huge companies. Like, there's only four big seed companies in the world now.
Mm-hmm.
They've, you know, from all the different ones, they've all been combined into, it's like three or four seed companies, that's it. And so they push all the genetically modified seed, but it only works if you use their herbicides and all the chemicals. So that's where they're making all the money. And they've really done a beautiful lobby job on the government to really get rid of small enterprise. These guys that represent major agricultural interests have huge billion-dollar budgets to lobby the government for what they want. And they're on every committee, and they've sold everybody this thing about you got to be technologically advanced and use all our, you know, GE crops, all our seeds, all this stuff. And it's just, you know, they got sold big, huge bill of sale on that stuff. So,
as meat producers, Tom and Simon face a unique challenge by living in the North. They have a hard time accessing a market to sell their product.
And we sort of saved everything, and then the one step that was missing right now for us, we had nowhere to, so there's no auction mart here to go take your cows in and sell them off. There's nothing like that. So the options here were to try and sell farm gate, which is uninspected, or go through the local abattoirs, where you can get inspection, and try to sell them. But none of the stores would buy this stuff, really. The big box stores and the other smaller supers, no one has meat rails anymore. They buy all their meat, they call it primals, from like XL Foods out of Southern Alberta or whatever they're called now.
Mm-hmm.
They buy primals. Nothing comes up swinging sides. There's no anything on the hook anymore. It's all just vacuum-packed primal cuts. So you say, I want 22 beef loins per, you know, whatever we're doing for the next month. Well, you can order those direct. So, and it's cheap price from the feedlot and all the rest of that stuff. So, but that's the one thing was missing, that the farmers couldn't access that. So, and the only other way to do it was by a farm gate. A lot of farmers like growing it, but they don't want to process, and they certainly don't want to have to sit there and sell their product. Many of them did. So what we're offering now is a shop where we're only going to buy local, and we're only going to sell local, and we're trying everything under the world in there, and we just got our smoker, and we're going to try some of that and see how it goes.
Nice. And is that the main way you're going to sell your products now, or do you sell your products in the local?
Yeah, we'll still sell by the sides and stuff, but it'll all go through the store.
Nice. Do you sell in anywhere in Whitehorse, in any stores or anything, or not at all?
Yeah, well, we used to sell at Riverside Grocery. It's a small little organic grocery.
Yeah.
And then also at the farmer's market.
Tom also has a contract to run a mobile abattoir trailer owned by the government of the Yukon, where he caters to farmers by offering custom slaughtering and processing. Although there isn't any demand for it right now, he says it would be very easy to get the trailer approved for organic slaughtering.
So I guess the last question I kind of have to wrap it up is, what are your hopes for the future of farming in the Yukon?
Well, I'd love for it to keep going, but I would also like to see people look at it as a lifestyle as opposed to a way to just make money. If you could get rid of that somehow and feed the locals with decent food and learn how to have regenerative agriculture, at least. The government, there's a couple people in there that are actually trying to work hard at getting more land out to more people. Smaller parcels, more effective use of the land, and try not to over-regulate the crap out of it and make it so onerous. I think that was the biggest thing that happened years ago. I know in Alberta, right when I graduated, they got rid of district agriculturalists that they used to have in all the ag offices throughout the province. And these used to be the guys that would go out and visit your farm and talk to you, and they represented the government and would do whatever they could. And the government got rid of those guys, and they all sort of got replaced by the salesmen from the big ag corporations.
Oh,
they took
no.
over all that. And so I hope we, you know, the guys here in the ag branch continue to try and help out farmers with really basic needs on, you know, how to do bookkeeping, how to create a farm plan, how to market your stuff, the really essential stuff. I look at it now, and we've come a long way. We have organic is actually in the policy, in the ag policy now, which never used to be. So that's a good thing. The government's more aware of what we do. The ministers are, we know them all, they know us. I think it'll work eventually, you know. We have two new inspectors up. We have two of our own organic inspectors up here now.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Yeah, so that's a good thing. And we're able to process certified organic food here too, so, you know, it's getting there.
As someone who has been interested in potentially farming up north as a career, what Bart and Tom had to say has definitely made me consider the complexities of doing just that. It's not as easy as saying, okay, I'm going to pack up my life and start a farm in the Yukon. There are huge barriers to being able to do that, especially accessing good farmland, adapting to the huge cost of farm inputs, finding reliable labor, and just learning to farm in a northern climate. But it sounds like the Yukon is slowly making progress, and slowly trying to support local food production, but the key word here is slowly. From what I've learned from Bart and Tom, change within the Yukon's agricultural policy isn't coming fast enough. Right now, the Yukon is far away from food sovereignty and food security. Sustainable agriculture that will be resilient in the face of climate change is key to ensuring the Yukon's resiliency in the coming years. The Yukon needs more farmers like Bart and Tom, who are actively stewarding land in a responsible way and pursuing and advocating for organic farming, and by doing that, advocating for a way of farming that is better for the soil, better for the animals, and better for the people consuming the food. And as I learned from Bart and Tom, for them to continue and for more people to start following their lead, policy needs to be changed in a way that will allow farmers to access affordable farmland. More small farmers, more responsible agriculture, and a more resilient food system. I'd like to say a huge thank you to Tom Rudge and Bart Bounds, who were so willing to help make this podcast happen. If you want to learn more about their farms, you can check them out online at elementalfarm.org and auroramountain.yukonfood.com. If you want to learn more about organic farming in the Yukon, go to the Growers of Organic Food Yukon website at organic.yukonfood.com. This podcast was produced by me, Dominique Kuhn. The songs that were used in the podcast were Home by Moontrix, Folk Tales by Nick Davies, The Farmer is the Man by Pete Seeger, Waltz of the Toads by Nick Davies, The Otter's Holt by Whalebone, and the song we're listening to right now is Solar Therapy by Moontrix. Thanks for listening to Organic Matters. See you next time.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, know the farmer is the man that feeds them all. If you'll only look and see, I think you will agree that the farmer is the man that feeds them all. Oh, the farmer is the man, the farmer is the man, lives on credit till the fall. With the interest rate so high, it's a wonder he don't die, and the middleman's the one that gets it all. Oh, the banker says he's broke, and the merchant's up in smoke, but the farmer is the man that feeds them all. It would put them to the test if the farmer took a rest, then they'd know that it's the farmer feeds them all. Oh, the farmer is the man, the farmer is the man, lives on credit till the fall. And his pants are wearing thin, his condition it's a sin, he's forgot that he's the man that feeds them all.